First Baptist Church of Redmond, November 8, 2020. Guest speaker, Patrick Noury. Time for a reset.
This morning I'm going to share with you some principles. Some of you may find them to be helpful. Hopefully you will. But I'm also going to share some personal sides of some things about me, just because, I know that the events of the last few days have affected people differently than others. Yesterday I was running an errand, and I was in the morning, and I was driving down the highway, and I noticed there was a person coming up the way. He was jumping up and down, throwing up his hands, smiling. You know, I don't think it took me by surprise, because I hadn't seen somebody in a state of that kind of happiness in a long, long time. And it caught my attention, but I looked over at him and he got my attention. He was doing this. And of course, that's when they had just announced that, you know, there was a new president. And I've really affected these last few days, and I decided to go ahead and wave to him and smile. So I did. I waved my hand and smiled, and I was real tempted to wave something else too, but I didn't. And so I just forged ahead. You know, look, he's welcome today. Everybody is welcome, legally anyway, in our country, to express how they really feel. And but it did strike me, reaffirm that I think we all need to do kind of a reset in our lives. Something that affected me so much indicated to me that perhaps my heart's really not in the place it should be, and my disposition is really not in the place it should be. And because this is truly the way I felt these last few days. I mean, this really does capture where I was. Some of you, no big deal. You can live above it. I think if you've got some secrets to share in that regard, you'll probably make a lot of money being able to get above, rise above all the troubles and everything. But this really did affect me. And it caused me to refocus on who the real owner of our earth really is. And I read this passage: the earth is the Lord's, and all it contains, the world and those who dwell in it. No matter what kind of changes, no matter what mountains fall into the heart of the sea, no matter what kind of troubles come into our lives and into our country, into our world, God, it still belongs to Him and everyone and everything in it. Man is not powerful enough to take God and remove Him out of existence. This is what, of course, those in the Enlightenment tried to do in the late 1700s, early 1800s. They tried to remove God out of thinking, out of the course of life. And that new religion was born, was called deism, where, okay, we'll acknowledge He's out there somewhere, but He has nothing to do with this world. It's what we make of it, and it's what we think about it. And it's just simply not true. The earth is God's and belongs to Him. Well, why is that so? Well, frankly, because He made it. He owns it. He made it. It didn't get here by itself. It didn't get here naturally. It got here because He made it and He put it here. And He did it for a reason. So I think that's one of the first things I can share with you that I know I'm trying to work on, is realizing that, hey, this world is not mine and I cannot change it. I do have the authority to preach a message, and there are times when God allows me to affect individuals with it. Some God allows to affect many individuals, and that's really, I think that's tremendous. But that's kind of our realm. I think we all have to take stock of what our realm really is. How is God working? In fact, we're exhorted to do that in Romans chapter 12. Let no man think of himself more than he ought to think, but to think so as to have sound judgment, because God has allotted to each a measure of faith. And I think that's what it's talking about. How is God working in you in that particular situation with particular people and circumstances that surround you? And I think that is exactly what we need to be doing and continuing to do. I was reminded too, I've been reading through the book of Jeremiah, and you know, the book of Jeremiah, his name, Jeremiah, means the Lord exalts. The Lord exalts. And this, of course, if you read through much of the book of Jeremiah and you read Lamentations, you'll know that Jeremiah's life did not exhibit exaltation, did it? I mean, what he did was deliver a message of, I mean, it was doom and gloom for the kingdom of Judah. They just would not repent. And today we call Jeremiah, though, the weeping prophet. That's what we call him. And we know that when he started delivering the prophecies from God to Judah, it was occupied a period of somewhere around 89 years. Now, can you imagine living a life? Your name means the Lord exalts. And I know this was a struggle. It's been a struggle for me. It's a struggle for all of us to realize that, hey, there is one good reason why the Lord exalts. He raises up. He's the one that determines and positions and interferes when he needs to and so on. The Lord exalts. But what we do when we follow him is we enter into a totally different realm that I don't think many Christians are really prepared to do. I think the image of a Christian is thought to be one of, well, if you're not joyous all the time or most of the time, if you're not figuring things out the way they ought to be and expressing gratitude, this kind of, you know, they call it victorious living, then you really don't have the Spirit of God. And I'll tell you, as I've been doing this whole thing now since the early 70s, there are periods of time when my life is very joyous, and when my life is seems like there are just a lot of good things coming together, and I see God at work and so on. During those times, I can say the Lord exalts. But to experience what Jeremiah did seems to be, I think, the call of the Christian, and I'll get into that a little bit later here. His life was really a life of suffering for simply obeying the voice of God. Early on in his life, when he was just a real young man, God appeared to him and spoke to him and told him exactly what he wanted him to do. Did not paint a rosy picture. It did not try to tell him, this is what you're going to do, but this is what I expect of you to behave like and be, and in spite of it all, it was, this is what I've sent you to do. 89 years of doing this simply for obeying, suffering for obeying the word of God, the voice of the Lord. One of these passages is seen in Lamentations 1, the very first verse. Look at this. How lonely sits the city that was full of people. She has become like a widow who was once great among the nations. She who is a princess among the provinces has become a forced laborer. That was a choice that Jerusalem had made. It took many, many years to bring about its fulfillment. During that time, It's said of the Lord that he rose daily, every morning, and appealing to the people to change and to turn back to him. Every day, it says, he did that. We didn't see it, Jews would say. We never saw that. But it was through Jeremiah, wasn't it? Every single day. And so when we have to do it one day out of the month and we suffer for it, you know, we get bothered by it. And this is really a natural part, or should be a natural part of our lives. We share in the same suffering that God is experiencing. And it demonstrates to me, I think, first of all, a reality. God does care. He is involved. He does experience. It says he carries our sorrows. He carried our sorrows and our griefs. It says he bore our griefs. And that's what he's doing in Jeremiah. For 89 years, he did that. He did that through the Lord. And then in the New Testament, it's real clear. It's part and parcel of being a Christian. Well, is there an application to our country, the United States? And I think there is. For those who are younger, of course, they don't have the perspective of somebody who may be a little older. My father was a pilot during World War II, and so I have that perspective of life. And that's an image that I was raised with. Others may have different images. But the thing that is true that we have to remember, that every country faces at one time or another in their existence. And that is this: the nations have sunk down in the pit which they have made. God did not do it. God did not force them. It's a pit that every single human, of course, has a choice. What are you going to do? But it's also true of nations. And as Judah made a choice, so I think every nation will make a choice. The wicked will return to Sheol, even all the nations who forget God. That is a fact. That's a true statement. It doesn't matter who you are. It doesn't matter who the nation is. One time or another, the choices are continuing to be made. Someone mentioned that we probably make close to 35,000 choices a day. Now, we're not keeping track of them all, but many choices are made per second in our daily lives. Some we become used to doing. It's all like old hat. We do them by almost like instinct. But there are a lot of choices that we do make that are done according to preference, but are not good for us. Can you imagine? 35,000 choices a day. This is how we're made. We're wired like this as human beings by God. And the choices are there to serve him, to follow him, or of course to turn away. That's true for the individual. It's also true for nations. This is, it's really a universal principle that we're looking at here. It's true. And I know in the book of 2 Peter, if you take the time to read through 2 Peter, in 2 Peter chapter 3, He gives us four practical ways that God is involved and has demonstrated to all men everywhere that he holds every single man accountable for what they do, say, or think. Three of those have already happened. And that is one where the angels fell, and it says that God committed to those who disobeyed, committed them to pits of darkness to await, of course, the judgment. Another one, which I find to be very interesting, because I can't think of any other event in the Bible that was a global event that held all men accountable to God. It's the flood. That was the one global event. And then he gives a localized event, Sodom, the city of Sodom. And after taking Lot out of the city, he judged the city. That was more of a local event. So he's demonstrated his not only righteousness in judging, his ability to judge for those who were the closest to him, angels. And then he did it on a global level. For everybody. Everybody's accountable to God. I don't care whether they're born in the United States or born in Europe or wherever they're born. Every single human being makes choices. And then there, of course, was the example of Sodom. And they made choices. And God held them accountable. And then the ultimate event, of course, is where Peter says in 2 Peter chapter 3, there will be a day that comes when the elements will burn with intense heat. And the earth and all its works will be burned up. The heavens will pass away. Heavens and earth will pass away with a roar. It will be the final day of judgment. Now that I can't be involved in. It's just not my power. It's not been given to me. God is the one who does that. But he's left plenty of warning. And in some ways, you and I do participate in that. We do participate in it by, of course, following him, don't we? People see through us that we are Christians. It's just unmistakable. For many, many times I have known people through these last many, many years, I can tell you that person, I believe, is a Christian. How can you tell that? You know their heart? No, I don't know their heart. But the disposition of being a Christian does affect your outward appearance. Now, not whether you look good or don't look good or, you know, have beautiful hair or beautiful eyes or whatever. I'm not talking about the physical appearance, but there's something that does. I've heard more expressions from people who have looked at Christians and said, you know what, there's something different about you. And the disposition comes out. And so we do participate in that way, in this whole thing of working with God. And God will be exalted regardless of what happens. So we're really looking at the universal principle of judgment. And the other thing we see in this passage out of 2 Peter is this: God knows how to rescue us. Notice this. If God did not spare, and so on, and if he rescued righteous Lot. Now, how many of us would agree with that statement? I don't think anybody would. Righteous would not be the word that comes to my mind about Lot. I mean, you read what happened there. First of all, he made the decision to be greedy with Abraham, and then there was such a problem that they had to separate, and Abraham gave him the choice. Choose where you want to go, and I'll choose the opposite way. What did Lot choose? He chose the green plains, the lush landscape of the city of Sodom. Have you ever been over in Israel in that part where they think Sodom and Gomorrah were? It's not exactly green. It has really changed. In fact, it's one of these things. You can see how the earth changes through the years. Well, it was once very lush and probably one of the most gorgeous places on earth to live would have been in Sodom and Gomorrah, in the cities of the plain, it said. Lot chose to live there. And then he chose to get involved in, I don't know what he was doing, but the people of the city, especially the leaders of the city, did not like the influence that he was trying to have on the city. And they held it against him. And then he offered his daughters in exchange to protect these visitors that had come in to the city of Sodom. And you look at that and you go, man, what was he thinking? Well, let me tell you, I think I know what he was thinking. And even though some of his deeds and his acts, we just would not, we'd blush over those. But it says, God rescued this man, this righteous Lot, oppressed by the sensual conduct of unprincipled men. For while living among them, felt his righteous soul tormented day after day with their lawless deeds. Now, there's a guy who had somewhat of a conscience and a disposition, wouldn't you agree? I mean, if in some ways, I mean, if you don't believe in God, or if you do believe that he exists, but your conscience has been so fried you don't really care, you're not going to be oppressed by the sensual conduct of unprincipled men. It's not going to bother you at all. Hey, free country, they can do whatever they want to do. But Lot, and that's why I think God called him righteous, because this is a disposition inside. This is what he really believed. This is what he thought. He felt his righteous soul tormented day after day with their lawless deeds. God knows how to rescue someone like that. And I thought, well, really, I'm in the same position. All of us, I think to one degree or another, are going to be affected by any decisions that our country makes in the future that will move away from an obedience to God. We're all going to be affected by it in one way or another. God knows how to rescue us. But notice this in 1 Peter chapter 4. And by the way, if you want to see what kind of a life God expects of us, starting in about 1 Peter chapter 2, after he reminds us of our salvation, being born again, and then he goes on to tell us what life, the various stages, whether it's being a slave or whether you're married or not married or whether you're a leader or not a leader. And he says, so as to live the rest of our time in the flesh, now that we're born again, for the will of God. And so this is a pretty important thing to define, isn't it? What does it mean to live the rest of our life in the flesh for the will of God, not for the desires of men, but for the will of God? Usually we kind of think of this, well, if I'm in the will of God, I'm going to be happy at least most of the time. And, you know, be a Christian, you're blessed, this kind of thing. I think sometimes we have to redefine what that really means. Well, I'd like to, what I do here is just is to help us see that we need to focus on our inner disposition. This was the thing that grabbed me yesterday. Oh yeah, I pay my taxes, I pay everything that I owe, I respect those in authority, and I do this and I do that and I tithe and yada, 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 you know. But what about my inward disposition when I'm in these circumstances that just not only rub me raw, but that are a real challenge for me? And that's what I want to do. That's how I think inside. Jesus said this, for from within, out of the heart of man, come all of these different behaviors. It's from within the heart of man. So the disposition really is very, very important. Here's our calling as Christians. I thought this was interesting out of 1 Peter chapter 2. For you have been called, believers. Now here it is. If you want to know what the calling of God is on your life, here it is. You have been called for this purpose, since Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example for you to follow in his steps. It seems to me that this is not the exception to the rule, but the rule. And when you see the people who really did get involved with God and following him and obeying him and doing what he had asked them to do. The loss and the suffering was pretty great. I can go through just about all of them, the prophets and people who are noted in Scripture. And Christ suffered unjustly, by the way. We all talk about his trial being unjust. And the things that, and he was righteous. In fact, he paid all of his taxes. There are several instances of that where he paid the taxes. He followed through on what he was supposed to do. He was respectful. In fact, when he healed a leper, I believe it was, he told him, you know, first, before you do anything else, go show yourself to the priest. And that was to acknowledge the authority of the priesthood in Israel. Priests were the ones who were given the authority to declare clean and unclean. And so he did what was right and yet suffered for us. Now you might say, well, yeah, but that was for sin. I mean, he paid for our sin. Yeah, he did that. But that's not the example he left for us, was it? He didn't leave us an example to pay for everybody's sins and therefore suffer. He suffered for doing what was right, leaving you an example for you to follow in his steps. Therefore, since Christ has suffered in the flesh, arm yourselves also with the same purpose. Arm yourselves. It's not just something you sit around thinking, well, if it happens to me, you know, God forbid it happens to me, and cross our fingers, you know, this kind of thing, so it doesn't happen to me. But arm yourselves with the same purpose. Realize that if you follow God and you take him seriously and you listen to his voice and you obey him, you are going to suffer. And we are going to suffer. And I think to this, the degree that our nation drifts into a path that does not honor God, we are going to suffer. That's just the long and the short of it. There are plenty of proverbs that speak of this. You know, when the wicked rise, the righteous hide themselves. That's one of the proverbs. It's just part and parcel of the conflict that exists in our earth. Those who follow God's law strive with the wicked. There's a conflict. Therefore, since Christ has suffered in the flesh, arm yourselves also with the same purpose, because he who has suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin, so as to live the rest of the time in the flesh, no longer for the desires of men, but for the will of God. In other words, we're making almost a public declaration. Although, like Lot, we are unrighteous, yet because of the inward disposition, we are righteous. And so sin is not going to play the normal part in me that it does in everything else that we see going on around us. Everything else is crumbling. It was with Jeremiah. Here he was in the nation and that was promised many, many things by God. And he was watching it crumble. 89 years growing up with these memories of what was passed down to him, but also with the reality that the nation was going to fall. And he suffered, and it was hard for him. At times you can see the depths of depression in him and the even the physical suffering that he underwent. And I'm sure it was painful. That's the same with me too. Part of my story is I have seen the country that I love that is not the same country as my father had been involved in World War II, had communicated to me and that I was a part of. It's changed. And all of you have different perspectives. I understand that. But it's painful, very painful, And it hurts to see it. And yet, I live not for that. I live for the will of God. Well, Jesus did it, you might say, and look what it got him. Is that for me too? Well, I think in the end, we have to realize in either case, whether it's rich blessings of prosperity or it is the suffering that we go through, it's for this reason. The first book, the first letter of Peter is all about this, so that God would be glorified either through the salvation of the wicked. And of course, Jesus died for that, didn't he? To save the wicked. Or through the judgment of the wicked. Both are going to be true. Those that respond are saved. Those that don't will be judged. That's a teaching of the New Testament. Romans mentions it this way, Romans chapter 3, let God be found true, though every man be found a liar, as it is written, that you may be justified in your words and might prevail when you are judged. We enter into that as believers. In some ways, little things can happen throughout the day where you're thinking, boy, should I say something? Should I not say something? Or what if I do say something? I'm going to lose my job, or I'm going to lose this or that. We're doing the same thing when we just live here in the midst of a world that's going this way. We're trying to hold the line in our lives with our families and so on. And yet one of two things is going to happen to the world around us in time. The wicked will become believers, or they will be judged. And either way, what will be true is that may God be found true, even though every man is found a liar at the cost of it. We enter into that. That's just what Jesus did too. Jesus promised that there would be a day to come that those who followed him would be called wicked, would be called evil, because they followed him. So living for the will of God, it's an inner disposition. And when I think of this, Psalm 46, God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. It starts in the mind up here. It starts, we think. In fact, there's a very famous scientist, the name of A.E. Wilder Smith, European scientist, who wrote a book about this. This was the title of his book, He Who Thinks Has to Believe. So it starts in the mind. And I think one of the things that's happening, particularly in our culture, is we place getting the right feeling and then believing something. And it's out of order. It's thinking. Thinking, you think about this verse and then you trust. You think and then you trust. It's not blind at all. God has demonstrated it through it, through life and through different events. So we take a passage like this and we ask ourselves, do I really believe it? Do I think much about it? In fact, that's what meditating on the scripture means. It's like a cow. What do they have? Seven stomachs? Is that what they do? Those of you who are biological, you know, whizzes here. They chew it, swallow it, regurgitate it, chew it, and so on. And it's something, that's what biblical meditation really is. We take a passage and we start thinking about it until that passage really begins to focus our attention. Rather than just reading something, closing the book and saying we've done our job. Have we thought? Yeah, we've thought. But we didn't think about it enough so that it begins to affect us. And I've got to be doing this much more in my own life, to where what I'm reading is more than just words on paper and a duty that I do, but rather thinking about it so it begins to affect my inner disposition. And as Jeremiah did, remember the promises of God for the future and for the present. There were times when he wrestled in faith with God. And there were times, too, you can see the conflict between part of a chapter that deals with the judgment of Judah and part of the chapter that deals with the future blessings that will come after judgment. Both those things are true throughout both Isaiah and Jeremiah. And you wonder, okay, what do I see here? Well, I'm seeing the heart of God, aren't I? It's almost like a father who says, oh, I hate to do it. My dad used to do that before he'd spank us. He'd look at it and he says, now you know what I'm going to have to do. You can see, you know, dad didn't want to do that, but he knew he had to do it. It was kind of this emotional and then duty. And you can see it in the passages in Jeremiah and Isaiah too. So we can think about what's happening, and we've got a duty around us to toe the line with certain things in our lives, with our families, with our jobs. It bothers me when I pay taxes and nobody else, or very few around us, really do, or they're really conscientious about it. That bothers me. It'd bother anybody. Hey, that's not fair. How many times do you catch yourself saying that throughout the day? That's not fair. Yeah, it's not fair. But again, when we realize that God owns everything, then let that affect you. Let that affect your inner disposition. And then also in the present, as we struggle, as we go through things, this is one of my favorite passages. I think my wife and I have kind of lived on this through our, 40 years of marriage now. He said, this I recall to my mind, therefore I have hope. What is that? The Lord's love, faithfulness, and mercy indeed never cease. He said, look, this is after the fall of Jerusalem. The fall of Jerusalem, the city of the great king. It's fallen. He says, the Lord's love, faithfulness, and mercy indeed never cease, for his compassions never fail. They are new every morning. Great is thy faithfulness. This has been one of my life verses for me. And I think just to kind of put it all together for us, I think the thing that we're going to need to learn more and more as time goes on here, especially with, I think, some of the monumental changes that are going to come down, they're obviously going to affect us. It's just this. It's this, I don't know if you've ever sung this as a hymn. It's called Trust and Obey, I think is what it's called. But that's what we're called to do, trust and obey. Just trust and obey. And so every time I get myself into a situation or I see myself into a time of this is hard, or I'm wrestling with this attitude or that thing that's been going on, or the, boy, you just want to take a hold of everything, say, no, do it this way. It's just trust God. Trust God and simply obey him. And he's big enough to take care of the things around us and to take care of the things in our size. He knows how to rescue us. And he knows how to get involved in judgment. And knows I have to leave with him. My job is just simply to take care of my inner disposition. I'm responsible for that, aren't I?